Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Deciphera Pharmaceuticals, Inc., we had the pleasure of speaking with Richard F. Riedel, MD, an associate professor of medicine at Duke Cancer Institute, and Brian A. Van Tine, MD, PhD, an associate professor in the Department of Medicine, director of the sarcoma program in the Division of Medical Oncology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, to discuss treatment gaps that have plagued the sarcoma field and research through which investigators are hoping to fill those gaps. In our exclusive interview, Riedel and Van Tine discussed the multidisciplinary management of patients with sarcoma, the clinical impact of the FDA approval of ripretinib in the gastrointestinal stromal tumor paradigm, and other exciting advances in sarcoma. How would you define the current multidisciplinary management of patients with sarcoma?
It's a great question. I really think a question that's critical to the care of patients. We know from trial data that patients who are cared for in centers with sarcoma expertise actually do better than those that don't. At our institution at Duke University, and I suspect that at Washington University in St. Louis with Dr. Van Tine, we treat patients very similarly in the sense that we gather input from all the key stakeholders. So whether it be surgeons, pathologists, radiation oncologists, radiologists, medical oncologists, it's really important to put a team together to evaluate these patients if we hope to give them the best outcomes.
I would use the word complex. I think that, this is a very evolving, quick-moving field that's gone from what we thought were 75 sarcomas now to 157. And there's been the need for the addition of interventional radiologists and physical therapists and psychologic therapists on top of just the standard chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation. And with evolving radiation techniques, knowing what to give whom is best served by a multidisciplinary board with expertise in this area, and even sometimes sub-expertise within some of the sarcomas, so some of them are treated very differently.
So Dr. Van Tine, would you say that genomic sequencing comes into play at all in sarcoma?
Actually, I do for two reasons. First, there is a lot of genetic predispositions which end with patients having a sarcoma. And, as we've been sequencing more and more, I've actually found patients with, say, retinoblastoma mutations that didn't have retinoblastoma as a child, and we're identifying these later. There's a role for finding those rare NTRK fusions. Occasionally, you get a change of diagnosis when you find a fusion, which was not picked up by even the best pathologists. Occasionally, bad-looking tumors are bad, but their genomics give us a clue of what's there. And sometimes you identify druggable events. And so there is a role, and I believe everybody, with the exception of a lot of the known translocation drivers, probably need to be sequenced at some point to make sure that we actually aren't missing something that could lead to a therapy advantage.
I agree with Brian. I think there certainly is the role for genome testing in tumors. In my mind, the question is whom and when. As Brian alluded to, there's a cohort of patients who have translocation-associated sarcomas, for example, synovial sarcomas, rhabdomyosarcomas, myxoid liposarcomas, for example. And at least for those individuals, I would say I'm not routinely doing testing in those, in part because the drivers of pathogenesis are driven in part by those translocations. And very rare, if at all, do they have secondary alteration that can be actionable. I will routinely consider testing for those individuals whose tumors are characterized by having karyotypic aneuploidy, so undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcomas, leiomyosarcomas, dedifferentiated liposarcomas, for example. I think those certainly we will consider testing for the reasons that Brian mentioned. You don't want to miss out on an NTRK fusion, for example, where we clearly have a highly effective drug that can benefit patients.
So Dr. Riedel, what would you say in terms of treatment gaps has plagued the sarcoma field, and how has research over the past couple of years aimed to bridge those gaps?
In my mind, the biggest treatment gap really centers around systemic therapy. We went nearly 40 years before we had a second FDA-approved agent. That was pazopanib in 2012. We went then another 4 or 5 years before another approval came. And I think, to be quite honest, part of that is that we are a victim of our own design, in the sense that when we develop our clinical trials, at least historically, they enrolled a large proportion of unselected patients, so a variety of histologies. In recent years, in the last 5 years, there's a very clear paradigm shift in that we are now designing clinical trials that are niche specific or histology specific. So a trial in PEComa, a trial in a desmoid tumor, a trial in PGCT. And now we're starting, I think, to see the benefits of our understanding the underlying biology, understanding the pathogenesis, using therapies that target those mechanisms, and now seeing beneficial outcomes for patients.
You know, and I would also look at that through a slightly different eye. When I was first training to, you know, become a sarcoma oncologist, I was told I was going to have to deal with phase two clinical trial data for the rest of my career. And, you know, I think this field has matured rather rapidly in the last decade by doing these unselected phase threes and demonstrating they could be done, which has led to this next generation of focused, you know, phase two and threes in these histologies. And I think that the patients have become more organized, we've become more organized, and the ability to do a PEComa trial that may lead to an FDA approval was unheard of, you know, just 12 years ago. And so I think this field is advancing. I think it's advancing quickly. And I think we've really gotten a much better sense of what we should be doing and actually what we can do. So I think this is all positive because I think we've gone through a huge learning curve and a maturation as a field.
Yeah, I'll just follow up on that, Brian. I think that's true. If for nothing else, we've learned that by collaborating with each other, both nationally and internationally, we actually can move the needle forward. And I think 10, 15, 20 years ago, that while there were certainly collaborative efforts, it's much more robust today than it was before.
I think this is, you know, really due to, you know, things like the formation of SARC and the European groups and the efforts of, you know, people who really were forward-thinking, like Larry Baker and Gary Schwartz and the group that was very early, and Bob Benjamin, that came together and said, we need to do something. And so, you know, I think we've come a long way from doxorubicin for everybody.
So, Dr. Van Tine, with that said, what, in your opinion, have been the most exciting advances in sarcoma?
This year, I think we're going to see some really interesting data coming out on MAGE-A4 as a T-spear. This is a really fancy targeted immunotherapy for synovial sarcoma. I think there's going to be some presentations this year at ASCO of some other phase three clinical trials, which may give us some other drugs, you know, TKIs. You know, I think the work of Matt Ingham at Columbia will be presented in uterine leiomyosarcoma involving some of his basic findings from the laboratory that's being translated, as well as some of mine. And so I think there's new agents, new ideas, and new life coming into the field with that, you know, it's exciting.
In the last year alone, we've had FDA approvals in epithelioid sarcoma with tazemetostat. We've had two FDA approvals in GIST with ripretinib and avapritinib. There may be soon to come or soon to be regulatory approvals in other rare disease states. So I think, you know, in 2019, ASCO highlighted advances in rare tumors as being the advance of the year or the ASCO highlight of the year. And I think sarcoma played a significant role in that. Studies in desmoid tumors, studies in TGCT. I think all of this in the last, you know, 12 to 18 months has sort of created enthusiasm within the field.
I'm glad I actually started training when I did, because this field has gotten very complex. And, you know, having grown up through all the trials, having seen all the drugs got placed where they are, I think that, you know, it's a much more complex field than we used to have doxorubicin, ifosfamide, dacarbazine. And so, you know, this is, gets back to, you know, pathology matters, knowing what it is matters. And then putting the right patient into the right paradigm now matters. And it's actually gotten a lot more complex than it used to be.
Annamycin and ilixadencil were granted orphan drug designations by the FDA in soft tissue sarcoma. How do these agents distinguish themselves from current options, and where do you see them being incorporated into the paradigm?
Annamycin is an anthracycline. Anthracyclines really have been the backbone for the treatment of sarcomas for 40 years. Doxorubicin, epirubicin, for example, are standard bearers. One of the challenges with those agents is that the potential for cardiotoxicity and lifetime limits in terms of what can actually be given to patients. Annamycin is a novel formulation. It's designed to have limited toxicity, at least in data that's been presented to date. It appears that the cardiotoxicity is limited. In addition, in a sarcoma lung metastases model, at least compared doxorubicin, it appears that Annamycin can accumulate within the tumors at significantly higher levels than the traditional doxorubicin-based therapy. And so I think there's some enthusiasm regarding that. That's in part the reason why it led to the designation that it received.
We've been trying to replace doxorubicin for a while. I mean, we've had albumin-bound doxorubicin. You know, we've had GPX150. There is an interest in this field in replacing the anthracycline. You know, but, you know, these trials are difficult and the bar is high. And so I think orphan designation that will allow for the development of these agents is actually quite important.
With respect to ilixadencel, the second agent that you mentioned, this is sort of in a completely different realm than the more conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy that we've been using for decades in sarcoma. It's sort of an off-the-shelf cell-based product. It consists of activated dendritic cells or what are called antigen-presenting cells. The study drug is administered intratumorally via injection, and it's designed to stimulate an immune response. So a very different treatment approach. It's been studied in GIST tumors when given in combination with standard tyrosine kinase inhibition, like sunitinib, for example. And I believe that it's moving forward in the clinical realm. I think there's some potential enthusiasm around the strategy just because it's something different than what we've been using for so long.
I'm actually quite excited about this. It's novel. It's different. And, you know, intratumoral injections are usually less toxic. So if it works, you know, this could be a huge advance and step forward. I think it's quite interesting that it's being developed in GIST. There is an unmet need, even with all the new drugs that we have in GIST, for actual a step forward in the terms of going towards a curative route. So if there is actually kind of novel activity here, I will be very excited to see it move forward.
Now, Dr. Riedel, you mentioned ripretinib earlier. How would you say the FDA approval of that agent has advanced the GIST paradigm?
Well, I think it certainly added another weapon to our armamentarium. Ripretinib is a switch pocket kinase inhibitor. It was evaluated in a phase 3 study known as Invictus. In that study, patients who had failed 3 lines of therapy, namely imatinib, sunitinib, regorafenib, the standard FDA-approved agents, were randomized to either ripretinib or a placebo. And in that study, what they showed was that there's a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. There was a numerical improvement in overall survival as well as response rate, and that led to FDA approval. So I think now we have 4 FDA-approved agents. Based on data from the phase 1 study that suggested that progression-free survival could be higher in earlier lines of therapy, it's now being explored compared to sunitinib in the second line setting, a trial known as INTRIGUE, which has completed accrual. Results are eagerly anticipated. It may in fact change the paradigm moving forward with respect to a new second line therapy, but that remains to be seen as we await the clinical trial results.
I'll be interested to see, because if we switch the drugs around, we actually affect overall survival. You know, as each point mutation arises and result of the last tyrosine kinase inhibitor, it'll be interesting to see what moving the order does long term. And so I think that I'll be very intrigued to see what happens.
You know, I think for GIST, we have been sort of stuck in this paradigm of tyrosine kinase inhibitor after tyrosine kinase inhibitor after, you know, TKI. And if you look at the data moving from first line to second line to third line, at least historically, there was diminishing returns. And so I think we also need to think about rational combinations. This goes back to the previous cell therapy-based product in combination with TKI that we just talked about, looking at sort of different therapeutic approaches so we're not just doing one-offs moving forward.
Now, Dr. Van Tine, have the NCCN or other guidelines in GIST changed since the approval? And if not specifically with regarding ripretinib, any other notable changes that are worth highlighting?
Well, I think that the other drug worth highlighting is for a very rare indication, which is avapritinib. You know, there's a very rare subset of GIST, which has a point mutation in PDGF, which is called D842V. And avapritinib has an unusually high activity for this rare group of GIST patients. And so, you know, to circle back where you were asking, do genomics matter? In GIST, clearly they do. And so knowing what your GIST is really important, because those mutations may alter the drugs you use. And for this kind of rather more indolent form of GIST, for which there really is no therapy, there now is. And so I think this addition of having a pretnib there is important not only to know about, but, you know, hopefully, you know, blueprints will circle back around and help us to try once again to develop this as an agent for the rest of GIST at the same time, given its exon 17 inhibitory properties.
I think avapritinib is a dramatic advancement for the field, particularly for the patient population who had no known effective systemic therapy. As Brian mentioned, it's highly active. The response rates in the clinical trial that supported its FDA approval were in excess of 85%, almost 90%. And again, that was for a disease where previously we saw no responses with the prior FDA-approved available therapies. So really a home run in my mind for a very unique patient population.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I think that that is also a drug that, you know, had a very complicated trial. It went up against regorafenib and looked just as good. And so I think this gets back to, you know, us learning about trial design.
So, Dr. Riedel, you mentioned the INTRIGUE trial, how it had completed enrollment. Based on the data that we've seen to date and what we know of both agents, are you hopeful that ripretinib will best sunitinib in that setting?
I'm certainly very hopeful that that's the case. It remains to be seen whether or not it pans out or not. Sunitinib is a difficult drug to tolerate. You know, hand-foot syndrome, fatigue, diarrhea, rash. When patients progress on imatinib, sunitinib is the current standard in the second-line setting. But I think patients have a difficult time with it. Similarly, they have a difficult time in the third-line setting with the regorafenib. Ripretinib, again, was studied in the fourth-line setting. It appeared to be well tolerated. It remains to be seen in the second line setting if the efficacy is at least as good as it was in the fourth line setting, hopefully better. We know that sunitinib in the second line setting, the median progression-free survival is around 6 months. And so we need to do better. And I hope that INTRIGUE is a positive study.
You know, I think we've been here before with very promising early data. So I think we just have to be careful extrapolating current practice from, you know, small subsets of data. And so for now, I think leaving retipretinib as a fourth line standard of care is standard of care. But I really do hope we get to change the order, or at least change the tolerability, because I agree with Rich that sunitinib is not an easy drug to follow after imatinib because imatinib is so well tolerated. Rich, I think one of the biggest efforts that is going on right now across the sarcoma field is actually, you know, within the NY-ESO and MAGE-A4 T cells. And I think that, you know, within the Midwest, we've had a good luck with finding patients that actually qualify. You know, how are, you know, the region around you, how are you getting the word out to screen all synovial and mixed round cell patients for not only HLA, but the actual targetable antigens?
A little bit of a challenge. At a full disclosure, right now, we're only doing the screening in the context of the clinical trial. Any patient that we see for synovial sarcoma or mixed round cell liposarcoma, we will screen in-house once we have consent. We are not actively screening outside of the clinical trial, though. Are you doing that?
No, I was just trying to see how you're best getting the patients to you so they can be screened.
I think there's a variety of ways to do it. We will often send out mailers to referring physicians to make them aware of the clinical trials available that we have at our institution. Referring practices will also often reach out asking if we have a clinical trial. We have not routinely taken advantage of ads and brochures and things of that sort. I think, to be quite honest, there's tremendous power in the use of power of social media, particularly for patient-facing material and then spreading by word of mouth. So I think there's a variety of ways, but I think those developing trials looking at those immune-based strategies are certainly very encouraging for those subsets of patients who have the appropriate HLA and tumor-associated antigen.
The other trial that I actually think we need to work really hard on as a field to find patients is actually the challenge of the frontline tazemetostat trial. You know, a lot of patients come to me already having had an anthracycline, and to actually accrue the epithelioid sarcoma phase 3, where we're mixing, you know, tazemetostat with doxorubicin, I think we also have to use events like OncLive to get the word out that these trials are there. Otherwise, you know, we're going to miss the opportunity to learn an answer, which is, does tazemetostat with doxorubicin improve, you know, the efficacy over just tazemetostat alone in a disease that I may see 5 patients a year?
That's a great point. The estimates would suggest that there's about 150 new diagnoses a year of epithelioid sarcoma. We struggle with the same issue. Individuals who've already received an anthracycline in the front line will not be eligible for that confirmatory phase 3 study. So we also have a limited number of patients, probably similar to three to five per year. And if half of those, you know, have already had an anthracycline, you're looking at 1 to 2 per high volume center. And I don't remember the exact sample size for the study, but it could be challenging not to accrue.
So I think one of the other trials that's really important to talk about is the Alliance Clinical Trial of Angiosarcoma, which is looking for a lot of patients. And this can be opened, you know, nationally through a lot of community practices. And I think we need more participation in this very slowly accruing trial. And it's kind of an interesting trial. Rich, would you like to describe it?
So this is a study that's being led by Dr. Junko Greeley-Olson at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. It's a study, as you mentioned, for patients with angiosarcoma. They're looking for 90 patients. There are two cohorts on the study. One is a paclitaxel naive patient population, and another is a paclitaxel pretreated patient population. For those that are paclitaxel naive, they're randomized in a one-to-one fashion to either paclitaxel as a single agent or paclitaxel in combination with nivolumab. For the patients who are paclitaxel pretreated, they will enroll on a single arm of cabozantinib in combination with nivolumab. So an interesting study design, as you mentioned, one that can be a little bit challenging to enroll to, but the fact that they have both the treatment naive and then the treatment experienced cohorts, I think are going to be important.
So, Ian, there's two other neoadjuvant trials going on in the US that I think we also could use support from. You know, the first is an NRG trial using an MDM2 inhibitor with radiation, AMG-232. It's led out of Ohio State by Meng Willever. And, you know, the other is a really neat SARC trial looking at, you know, the addition of a PD-1 to radiation. And these trials can actually happen in patients which, you know, you wouldn't classically give aim to because of age.
I agree. There are a number of studies that are ongoing that have the very real potential to be paradigm shifting. And so we certainly appreciate the support of our community-based colleagues, as well as academic colleagues, who try to bring these trials to fruition.
Yeah, no, I think these are the ones I'd like to highlight for now and just get out the message that there are a lot of opportunities, you know, there's a lot of new interesting things going on, and this is a quickly moving field. And so, you know, what I'm doing today and what I may be doing next week could be entirely different trial-wise.
I would just close by encouraging the listeners of this particular event to lean on your academic colleagues, partner with those in the sarcoma centers to understand what options may be available. Options are changing and have changed significantly over the last several years. So a therapy that we may not have had available a couple of years ago may now be available either part of a recent FDA approval or as part of an ongoing clinical trial. So the listeners, please consider partnering with your sarcoma-based colleagues at academic institutions to try to give your patients the best outcomes that they deserve.
I absolutely agree with that sentiment. So thank you very much for including me in this exciting conversation with my good friend.
Agree. Thanks, Brian.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Deciphera Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.